Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, November 3rd. This is our weekly news roundup, and we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with our colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner, and we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now, we'll look at some of the news here on the Cape and the islands and the South Coast. Patrick, let's begin with the powerful storm that came Sunday into Monday, left a lot of folks without power, and there were some very big wind gusts in this storm.
Yeah, and these really ramped up early Monday morning. We're talking about 3, 4 in the morning, so a lot of people might have been in bed, but a lot of them might have lost their power, at least temporarily. These were gusts that reached hurricane force, really. There was a 93-mile-per-hour gust reported at Pompanesett Beach, and there was one of 95 also in Mashpee that was reported, or in East Falmouth that was reported, I believe. In any case, these were really strong wind gusts. Obviously, they brought down a lot of trees, a lot of branches, and did cause a number of power outages. I think we're looking at about 18,000 across the Cape and Islands, or Cape and Vineyard, really, at the height. That came down to about, 6, 7, 8,000 Monday. But the winds continued through Monday and continued to cause problems, and we in the newsroom at the Cape Cod Times were listening to the scanner and listening to police and fire responding to a branch down here, a tree down, maybe on a house. Nobody was seriously injured from everything we could tell from the storm, but there were branches and trees that were coming down. And those power outages continued in a lot of ways. And Nantucket got off quite a bit easier. They didn't have any reported power outages pretty much throughout the storm from what we could tell. That's not to say that National Grid, that serves Nantucket, didn't have its problems in other parts of the state. I think in total there were about 200,000+ people across the state who were without power at one point or another. And some of them, I think, are still without power at this point. I think they're still getting power onto some areas on the Cape and Islands. Largely it's been restored. But it really was a windy storm and one that did quite a bit of damage in terms of trees coming down. A tree trimmer is how one local, actually Charles Orloff, who's the executive director of the Blue Hill Observatory and Science Center in Milton, also a Mashpee resident, often comments on weather around here, and he called it a tree trimmer, which was a pretty appropriate headline for us.
Well, this time of year, those trees still have their foliage, so it definitely they're catching a lot more of the wind than they would, say, in another month when they don't have their leaves.
Yeah, and it's telling that the time of year and kind of the direction of the wind can have a lot to do with how a storm plays out. For instance, in this case, the direction of wind made it less of an issue for some place like Town Neck and Sandwich, which really bears the brunt when it's a nor'easter. And in this case, the wind was coming from another direction, and they said that caused less erosion than might happen with another type of storm. So again, all these factors play in. Time of year, time of day, even again in terms of the high tide and when that happens. I know Falmouth saw quite a bit of overwash onto some area roads, including a lot of sand that blocked a road and led to some pretty dramatic photos of them clearing that road, Menahunt Road, I believe. In any case, it depends on a lot of factors how a storm plays out and what the effects are.
Well, it does raise some red flags when you think about what a hurricane could do if we catch one in August, September, early October, when there's still leaves on the trees. Lots of people worrying about that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I saw some commentary from some folks who really do follow weather, and they kind of said, well, we haven't had a really serious hurricane hit the Cape, and if this is any indication with this storm, which wasn't a hurricane, it could be a real problem in terms of the timing and what could happen in the case of an actual hurricane.
Now, Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station also lost power, at least in part of its facility. Tell us what happened here.
Yeah, and it's something we watch closely. I know Pilgrim officials are watching closely, and activists who don't like the way the plant operates watch closely, as do nuclear regulators at the federal level. In the past, the plant has lost power, and it has led to more serious problems. This loss of power was to a particular system at the plant, and it was something that feeds support buildings for the plant. seemingly not as serious. They did call it a major loss of communications ability, but they basically said we have backup communications that we can use, and these are in the form of radios when it comes to the fire and police in Plymouth. But it did have an effect on what they call the uninterruptible power supply, which should have kicked in and taken over this kind of electrical function immediately after this line. It was a 23 kilovolt line that got hit by a tree, I believe, a falling tree, was affected. And that didn't work. So again, it raises, questions that always seem to come up with the plant, which has to have to do with backups and backups of backups. And they say there's a lot of redundancy out there. And again, they said in this case, there was no danger to the public. It had to do with communications. They had alternatives for those communications. Eversource, there was some question about how the notification happened. Eversource said, once we were notified, we got out there. The plant operators and I believe the fire officials in the area said that they were surprised that the line wasn't taken care of sooner.
It was 17 hours before that line was back up into service.
It did, yes. The firefighters said they responded to the tree fall at 2:45 a.m. and again shortly before 6 p.m. the next day and still hadn't seen it addressed by Eversource. It was still sparking at that point.
That seems of concern right
Seems
there.
Like a long time, and Eversource says they're looking at their operations and Entergy, I think, is looking at how those notifications are made as well. So they're all kind of looking at what went wrong there. Again, luckily it wasn't a major system that was affected, but still something that is always of concern.
Patrick, a big river restoration project got underway this week in Falmouth. It's been a long time in the works.
Yeah, this is the Coonamesset River, and one person who was at this groundbreaking that took place on Monday for this $3.5 million river restoration project said he has emails about it going back to 2003, so they've been looking at it for well over a decade. And the work is essentially to take the lower Coonamesset River and restore it to what it once was. I mean, this is a kind of a winding tributary that had herring running through it. It had alewife. It had eels. It had all these fish species. And over the years, since the 1700s even, it was essentially manipulated to perform other tasks for people. Grist mills, we're talking about wool mills, and the cranberry industry kind of moved in the 1800s. So that affected the river. It affected what was done there. It blocked up different parts. So now they're going to go in and they're going to remove what's called the lower dam. They're going to restore an 11-acre bog. They're going to have to dig up the sand that's accumulated in the area. That's kind of the first phase of the project. The full project includes restoring essentially two miles of this stream to what it once was, removing two dams, replacing a deteriorated culvert, making it more fish friendly. And the hope is here, obviously, to bring back the kind of more historic populations of herring and alewife that have gone away in areas like this. One of the things that happened, as everybody knows, is you can no longer take herring from local rivers, and that's because of kind of these types of things and because of overfishing that had been done in the past. This is, again, hopefully, according to the folks who are behind this, a way to restore those herring populations and restore the basic ecological health of that area.
A very ambitious project, looking at a large piece of land there, over 200 acres is what they expect the impact on.
And a lot of organizations that have been involved in preserving that land, but it's going to certainly take some time. They're looking at it a couple of years before they can really get everything in place.
Sarah Brown joins us right now from the Vineyard Gazette. Hello, Sarah.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Sarah, a big topic of discussion on the island right now. The high school football team announced this week it doesn't have the players to finish the season, which means no Island Cup.
It does, and that's certainly really disappointing news for a lot of people, certainly the players and their families on both islands with regard to the Island Cup, but also the Vineyard team and people who were really looking forward to that rivalry game. But as you said, the regional high school here made the decision yesterday that tonight will be the final game of their season, and they will be forfeiting the rest of the season, and that, as you said, that includes the Island Cup. And administrators, as you said, this is because of a lack of numbers. They said they did not take this lightly. It was a really tough decision to make. But, 36 students tried out for the football team this year, which wasn't enough to field both varsity and junior varsity teams. So there was no JV season this year. And then there have been injuries, a few students dismissed because of disciplinary issues. Others left the team. And there are also several students who just weren't ready to play at the varsity level, like freshmen, so they wouldn't be able to be starting games. So there was just really, it was a case of not having the numbers to field the team safely with consideration for the safety of the players who would be playing. So so certainly a disappointing decision, but one that they said they had to make. And it's also, this has been a couple years of transition for the football team here. The longtime coach, Don Herman, retired a few years ago. And there have been two different coaches after the last few years. And the team's record this year was 1-7 with the win coming from a forfeit. So, so certainly this is kind of a transitional time. And, the athletic coach and the head of the boosters here on the island said, it's been increasingly difficult to field football teams, especially for small schools like the Vineyard. And the popularity of the sport is kind of waning compared to some of the other sports, as you can see from the number of students trying out. So, there's some concern about the future of the program, certainly in the community, but, the athletic director at the high school said they're going to work to develop a plan to make sure that, this isn't a spiral down, but just kind of a rebuilding time. And that they're going to have a meeting once the season is over to talk about, how they can boost the program. But as you said, it's obviously tough for the team and for the community. And certainly it's tough not to have the Island Cup because everyone really looks forward to it. It was going to be in Nantucket this year. And I think it's only the second Island Cup the second time the Island Cup hasn't happened. I think the first time was because Nantucket couldn't field the team in, 2009. So it's a rarity not to have this rivalry game that everyone looks forward to.
Saw a lot of comments on the website with this story on your website. People really have some strong feelings around this.
They do, yeah. And I think there's some people certainly who are very disappointed. There's also, some people who have concerns about the sports, that maybe the decline in popularity is because of concerns about the sport. And, certainly there's, as we all know, there's been a lot of talk about the injuries related to football and and what could happen to football players. And also, though, I think people understand, though, that it would be that's a good decision this year to kind of halt the end of the season to have tonight be the final game for the safety of the players because, if you don't have enough kids, it's not safe to go forward. So I think there's probably going to be a lot of discussion and a lot of talk about where the team goes from here.
Sarah Brown joining us from the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thanks for that.
Thank you. And I should mention that the team will be playing tonight at the high school. So if anyone wants to come out and cheer on the final game here on the Vineyard, that will be happening. Thanks.
Thank you, Sarah. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And on the phone right now with us is Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hiya, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, for a number of years, there's been issues at Chatham Airport around skydiving. Now there's a new concern. Tell us about this.
Sure. Well, as we've talked about before, the whole skydiving situation in Chatham is now in court. One of the issues that hinges on is whether Chatham is considered technically a congested area, which the FAA does not allow skydiving over. Now, a couple weeks ago, a couple guys came into Chatham Airport with ultralight airplanes. Now, these are basically experimental aircrafts, small, usually self-built planes. Somebody described them as basically a seat with a motor and some wings. And they took off and landed from the airport here in Chatham. And it turns out that ultralights, while they're not regulated by the FAA because they're considered experimental aircraft, they're not licensed or anything, but the FAA does not allow them to operate over congested areas. And there was a complaint filed by one of the airport critics. And at the airport commission meeting last week, one of the members proposed that the town ban ultralight aircraft because of the fact that he believes that Chatham is a congested area under the FAA rules. Now the commission didn't go for that. They decided that they would wait until the whole congested area issue is determined by the FAA, and right now that's sort of all tied up in the court case, and so. The question about whether that is going to have an impact on whether ultralights will be able to continue operating at the airport remains up in the air. Now, some of the airport commission members said this was the first time they'd seen ultralights at the airport in many years, so they didn't really see it as a big issue, and they didn't find much in their research about safety concerns, at least for people on the ground. There have been accidents of ultralight aircraft, but they didn't involve anybody on the ground getting hurt. So the matter is on hold, but again, it hinges on some of the same issues as skydiving, and that whole skydiving case is going to come up again in December, and the Airport Commission said after that they'll take a look at the ultralight issue again.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure, Steve. Thanks.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times is with us. Patrick, some reporting you did this week appears that leatherback turtle deaths may be on the rise. Can you tell us what that's about?
Yeah, we've seen a lot of strandings, whether it be leatherback turtles or dolphins, happening this year. And in several cases, as with the dolphins, actually cetaceans in general, I suppose, the strandings seem to be up. In this case, we're talking about leatherback turtles. These are the largest turtle species in the world, heaviest reptile in the world. They can get up to 1,500 pounds. These are big animals. And what they're saying is they've seen a jump this year, certainly over last year, in the number of dead leatherbacks that have been showing up on Cape beaches. This year, there have been 27 of these turtles that have been found dead on beaches. That's over 12 that had occurred last year across the Cape and Islands, essentially across this region. The Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, that's Mass Audubon, are the ones who respond to these. And they say there are a number of potential reasons for this. It looks like there are more jellyfish, and they've seen more of these dead turtles showing up in Vineyard Sound. That's compared to other years where they've shown up on the east side of Nantucket Sound. So that amount of jellyfish and these turtles coming in there and also being here a little later, it seems like the jellyfish showed up a little later. Mm. Turtles showed up a little later. The weather has still been nice. You've had more boaters out there. All of these lead to potential boat strikes, which is one of the main causes that they're seeing for these leatherbacks dying. That and being tangled in nets, essentially, or being tangled in fishery gear, or what they're saying are the main concerns. So again, they're seeing more, and they seem to think that that's the reason. It's kind of this congested area in Vineyard Sound where there's more of these turtles, and again, potentially more boats out there. Up until recently, the weather has again been nice enough for boating, and people have been out there a little later.
And a response? Are they suggesting any response to this uptick?
Well, I think they want to just make people aware so that, again, if you're out there and you're on your boat and you're not thinking about it, that you think more about where you're going. And obviously, they're always looking at fishing gear and ways to improve it and ways that it won't lead to these types of entanglements that have taken place.
Josh Balling joins us right now from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, special town meeting this week. Tell us what was on the agenda there.
Well, it's coming up on Monday, actually, and we've got a 27-article warrant topped off by three articles regarding recreational marijuana sales. Like a lot of towns around the state, Nantucket trying to get itself prepared for the establishment of recreational marijuana businesses. And there are three articles there. The first one would actually establish a moratorium on any businesses opening until the end of next year. Town officials say they are a little bit concerned about anything opening up before the state has finalized all its regulations, which hasn't happened yet, and they want to take some more time to plan for those businesses to open. The second article is a zoning article, which, if the moratorium fails, would place recreational pot stores in a couple of business districts in the Mid-Island area, not downtown. And the third article, as far as marijuana goes, would increase the local sales tax on marijuana sales from 2 to 3%. There's 24 other articles on the warrant. There's a $2.2 million appropriation, between $1 and $2 million for a new firehouse. They've already approved, voters have already approved $15 million for that, but they need some more after the bids came in. And there's also the acquisition of a piece of downtown waterfront real estate to improve a busy downtown intersection. That's for about $500,000.
Commercial scallop season opened on Wednesday. How's it going?
Well, the first couple days, so far, so good. As any scalloper who's been out there more than once will tell you, you can't judge a season by a couple of days. But in recent years, the Nantucket scallop harvest has not been the best, and opening day has not been the best. So there's a little bit of optimism out there. There was about 25 boats in the harbor and 12 to 15 in Matticat Harbor, and most of the fishermen were back to the dock by 10 or 11 o'clock with full loads. They're being paid $13 a pound by the fish markets, and Nantucket Bay scallops are retailing out here on the island for anywhere from about $18 a pound to $24 a pound.
Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Patrick Cassidy, we had our Barnstable County Commissioner Ron Beattie creating another controversy this week with a Twitter post. Tell us what this is about.
Sure. This goes to the hashtag MeToo movement that's certainly gained a lot of attention nationally, internationally. Obviously, this started, before I think even Harvey Weinstein, but has led to a lot of problems for folks like himself and Kevin Spacey more recently, as people are coming forward and alleging these sexual assaults, sexual harassment. And in this context, Ron Beattie Jr., Ronald Beattie Jr., who's a already controversial county commissioner for Barnstable County, came out with his own Twitter post, and he said, "This so-called hashtag MeToo Twitter trend is a bunch of nonsense, in my humble opinion." He tweeted that October 16th and then removed it. This is a little bit of a trend with him where he will tweet things out that are pretty controversial, and he does remove those tweets at times. But certainly people see those things, and certainly there were a lot of people upset with that particular post. And some of those people showed up to the county commissioner's meeting on Wednesday. There were five women who showed up who all identified themselves as survivors of abuse or harassment, and they were calling him out for this and saying, "Well, are you saying that my experience," and in one case a woman said her experience of being raped at the age of 17, being sexually assaulted in middle school, "are you saying that's nonsense?" And so they were really looking for some action to occur, a reprimand, a public reprimand at the very least of Mr. Beattie. Again, Beattie has in the past raised controversy with as recently as this summer, where he called for basically shark hunting. He was calling for a shark hunting to take place in terms of great white sharks, and that raised a lot of hackles. This is another instance where he's done that. The chairman of the Barnstable County Commissioners, Leo Kakunis, says he's really fed up with having to deal with these issues that are really, in his mind, ancillary to the county commissioner's duty and their mission. There's a lot of things that they're facing, Kakunis says, and this shouldn't be something that distracts from what they're doing. They've talked about a pledge of ethical and professional behavior. Kakunis says he's going to introduce that for county employees and elected officials, but says really he can't do anything legally to stop Mr. Beattie from expressing his opinion, as he says, his humble opinion on Twitter, and therefore they're kind of stuck where they are in terms of him being an elected official. And, he certainly has freedom of speech like everybody else, but it seems like he tends to go to areas where there's always going to be backlash from people who are upset with what he says. And he seems to kind of have this trend of upsetting different groups of people. And this is certainly no exception. This has upset quite a large number of people who say they're going to continue to push for some sort of action against him.
And the Twitter account from which he posts these identifies himself as a county commissioner. And I think a lot of people feel like if you're identifying as that, the way you speak should be held to a different standard.
That is an argument that's made. It's pretty easy to look not too far to a Twitter account that's operated by the President of the United States and find a similar analogy where people are upset with the things that Donald Trump has been tweeting. Beatty certainly sees himself of that line of politician and is somebody who speaks his mind, at least on social media. He did not respond to these women when they showed up at the county commissioner's meeting this week. Was quick to continue to respond on Twitter. Again, a seeming method that the president would appreciate, and Mr. Beatty obviously takes after that sort of politician in line of thinking.
In Sandwich, a dispute between neighbors and heritage museums and gardens has resulted in a lawsuit. Now, this goes back a number of years, but this phase of the case is nearing an end. What's happening here?
Yeah, they've been in court for about, I think, 2 weeks now, they wrapped up testimony yesterday. They still have to do closing arguments. That's expected to be scheduled in the future here, not immediately. But this goes back, as you said, to, I think, 2014 is when Heritage Museums and Gardens got their first permit for the Aerial Adventure Park that they then eventually proceeded to build. They got a certificate of occupancy in 2015. Old Kings Highway Historic District Committee signed off on it. Neighbors filed their first complaint in this sort of legal action in 2014 and immediately were pointing to the fact, first of all, I think, that they weren't notified. And the reason they weren't notified, abutters are generally notified when a project is going to take place in different towns, is because Heritage put the wrong address on the permit. Heritage President Ellen Spears has said in the past and testified in court that there was no intent to mislead the neighbors. The neighbors who we've talked to throughout the years aren't buying it. They think it was purposeful. They also are worried about their property values. They're worried about traffic and congestion and the character of the neighborhood. They're saying this park is bringing more congestion and that their property values are going to suffer for it. They got into a lot of the nitty-gritty of property values and whether, you know, who you believe in terms of property values going up and inconsistencies even with the way property is assessed. But the judge in this case, Cornelius Moriarty, told the two parties that he wanted them to focus on the applicability of what's called the Dover Amendment, which is something that allows basically projects to move forward if they have an educational component or in other cases, whether it's a building to be used for a certain purpose or solar panels put on a school. As long as it has an educational component, it's somewhat immune to kind of local zoning restrictions that might otherwise be in place. It's a very hard and fast rule in many respects. And he said, you got to focus on that. Is this an educational facility or is it not? And he wants them to focus on that, I think, as far as their closing arguments and probably closing briefs or whatever they have to put forward. So, again, a lot of different issues here. Really started with the wrong address, neighbors feeling misled, the fact that they were worried about traffic and congestion, but sounds like it's probably going to come down to this issue of whether this is an educational use or not for this property. It's a zip line, again, for anybody who's not aware. It's basically a zip line aerial adventure park. I think they even had like a physics professor testify that he took his class there to teach mm-hmm. them about physics. So obviously that's falling on the side of Heritage saying, yes, this is an educational use. But again, neighbors are having a hard time buying that and certainly aren't buying it legally.
Neighbors saying it's an amusement park.
Essentially, yes.
Ed Miller joins us from the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Ed, Wellfleet selectmen faced a choice this week over what to do with an empty building. And like so many discussions at this level where we live, the topic was soon touching on affordable housing. Tell us what happened.
Yes. The building that in question here is the former Council on Aging building in Wellfleet. It's about 2,000 square feet. And it's really been abandoned. It's been unoccupied now for more than 10 years. It sort of looks a little bit like a barracks building. But the town has been talking about what to do with it for years. And earlier this year, it was studied by the Building Needs and Assessment Committee in Wellfleet, and they determined that the structure, the upper structure of it, is basically a total loss and needs to be torn down, but that the foundation and the basement are in perfectly good condition. And so they recommended taking off the top part, capping the basement, and figuring out what to do with the site. And the selectmen voted at their last meeting, 4-1, to put up a new building there and use it for town offices to house three departments, the building department, recreation department, and health and conservation, all of which now are in the Department of Public Works building, which they claim is overcrowded. The one selectman who voted against this decision, Kathleen Bacon, in a for quite a striking scene, really, one of the more striking ones I've seen at a Wellfleet selectman's meeting, really emotionally objected to the decision, saying that Wellfleet was woefully behind in providing affordable housing for residents, and that this was a perfect location for that kind of housing. It's a walking distance to the center of town. It's right near the Flex bus stop on Route 6. There's a direct tie-in to the town water system. And she pleaded that the local housing authority at least be given a chance to do a study and see if it's feasible to use it for affordable housing. And the chair of the housing authority, Elaine McElroy, was also there, and she similarly asked the selectmen not to rule out that possibility and to let the housing authority do some study of it. She suggested that the site could accommodate between 6 and 10 rental apartments. But the majority of the selectmen were unmoved, and so they voted to go in the direction of more town office space.
That sounds like quite an evening of discussion then.
Well, yeah, it was. There were several things that were interesting about it. One was that two of the selectmen, Jerry Houck and Dennis Murphy, at first appeared to be undecided on the question and made various remarks about how they weren't really sure what should be done. Murphy suggested that it might take 4 years to come to a definitive decision about how to use the building. But then when Murphy called for a motion, he said, we have two options. One would be affordable housing. The other would be additional municipal use. And do I hear a motion, he said. And Janet Reinhart, another selectman, moved that they use it for town offices. Vote was taken, and there was no discussion really about the whole affordable housing question. After the vote was taken, the town administrator, Dan Hort, commented that he was sympathetic to Selectman Bacon's objections, and that he pointed out that at a recent housing seminar that's being held here in town, it was reported that Wellfleet, with 2.3% of its housing stock deemed affordable, was at the very bottom of the barrel on Cape Cod, and that it was that was embarrassing, he said, and that we need to work on this. We all need to work on this, he said. Still, they went the other direction in their decision.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back to the News Roundup. On the Point, we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And with us on the phone right now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve. And good morning, Patrick.
Morning, George.
George, the island's prosecutor was found guilty of misconduct. This is a case that's been unfolding for a little while. Explain it for us.
Yeah, so this is Laura Marchard. She's an assistant district attorney with the Cape and Islands District Attorney's Office. And she had been under allegations that she prosecutorial misconduct in several cases on the island. Three counts were brought before the Massachusetts Board of Bar Overseers. They held hearings over a couple of months, but it was 8 days total of testimony that they heard from a variety of witnesses. And last week they issued their decision, saying that in one of the counts, she was guilty of misconduct. Interestingly, though they didn't find her responsible in the other two counts, they talked about a lack of candor overall for Ms. Marchard in these cases, and also sort of took a shot at the district attorney's office as well, finding it unfortunate that both Ms. Marchard and a first assistant district attorney who testified talked about this being business as usual for the Cape and Islands district attorney's office. So this dates back, believe it or not, to cases in 2014. And actually, in one case, a judge who was sitting on the bench stopped the proceedings for the day and admonished Ms. Marchard during the actual case, saying that what she was doing was not right.
And what is the district attorney saying about this?
Well, it's interesting. You know, he issued a prepared statement on this. And he is doubling down here, saying that there's an intention to appeal the one guilty finding on the second count. And Ms. Marchard's attorney is also saying that they don't feel as though the bar counsel proved that count, and so they're considering an appeal as well. They have 20 days to do this. But the board was pretty clear that they heard a lot of testimony in this case. In fact, they said they thought that the case was over litigated, is the word that they used. And so it seems unclear what new evidence they're going to interject here that's going to change the minds of this board that issued the ruling.
George, you also have a story this week about, it's a great Halloween story. It's really about one neighborhood or one block, I guess, that's become a destination for kids on Halloween. Briefly, tell us what this is about.
Yeah, so I had a lot of candy at my house, but no kids coming to the door, unfortunately, so I've had to eat that candy.
I was going
to
say, but it's all still gone, right, George?
Right, absolutely. But there is this neighborhood here in Vineyard Haven that's sort of become the magnet for trick-or-treaters on the island. It's a historic neighborhood. It's called William Street, and the people there go all out and buy tons and tons of candy, thousands of candy bars, in fact, and some of them dress up. We have some great photos of folks dressed up as characters from The Wizard of Oz, for example, and it's just a great community event, and it's just, you know, you don't see this a lot of places across the country. You know, trick-or-treating is still something that people do, but to see that many kids and people just embracing this the tradition is great.
One of the article was saying there would be lines of kids 20 to 40 deep sometimes in front of houses.
Yeah, it's incredible. And, you know, the people start buying their candy like months in advance so that, you know, they don't blow their budgets in one fell swoop.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much. Have a good weekend.
Yep. Patrick Cassidy with me from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, it appears Kituit Center for the Arts will be expanding its campus, and it sounds like this came about rather quickly.
Yeah, there's been a lot of action in the arts community on the Cape recently. This was kind of the most visible in some respects. The Kituit Center for the Arts is expected to close December 1st on two adjacent Route 28 properties that will add an acre and a half to their already three-acre campus. They have some other property in the area that's not specifically part of that campus, but they have basically this now chunk of property out there all in the same area. And they said, listen, this was as much a surprise to us as anybody. This came up for auction earlier in October, I believe, and they had to act quickly to decide whether this was something they were going to want to act on. it seems when you look at just the layout, you know, aside from obviously how much money they're gonna have to spend on it, a no-brainer in some respects. This is a gas station that a lot of people will probably know as they pass by it, and an old bakery that are the two parcels. And they're in between the actual facilities for the Kituit Center for the Arts, which they've really been working on in recent years, and the other property that they already own on the other side, which I think is still kind of rented out or maintained privately, but that they own. And so it really kind of completes this large piece of land that they now own out there. They say they're still trying to figure out exactly what they're going to do for it and with it. They're looking at increased parking as one thing that they certainly need. They say they're often finding their parking lots are filled up. That obviously is something that they want to see. They want to see people coming to events there. So they'll be looking at how exactly they pay for it. They're going to do a funding drive. I think they already have some money in the bank that they're going to be using towards it. In total, the two parcels that they already have are assessed at $2.5 million. I think a large part of that is the improved parcel that their facility sits on, really. And then again, they own these two other parcels nearby. They say these new parcels are going to give them basically added frontage, allow them to kind of increase the curb appeal of what they have there already.
A new housing project for autistic adults is moving toward construction, and now that group behind that has a new leader.
Yeah, they chose for the Cape Cod Village, Inc., which is this project that's planned for Orleans, Dennis resident Susan Johnson to be the nonprofit's new executive director. They have a lot of loans, a federal loan of $3 million, a $2 million state grant, $950,000 in Community Preservation Act grants from seven towns, I think, on the outer and lower Cape, and another $800,000 in donations to go towards this project, which is supposed to provide 15 rooms in two buildings for adults with autism. Community kind of main building will also be available on the four-acre parcel. It's located between Old Colony Way and Child's Homestead Road near, if people know, the Mid-Cape Home Center is out there. And they really did this. The folks who started this were the president of the Cape Cod Village Board, Robert Jones, and his wife, Lauren, with the idea of being prepared for people with autism who are in either, a school or in other facilities, and they kind of age out, and where do they go? Who do they live with? Maybe their families can't take care of them anymore and need to have some place for them to be and live as adults. And this was the idea with this, is to have a place where they can live with support, but also be really integrated into the community. And that location is really close to downtown Orleans and is really a location that gives them access to a lot of the facilities down there. So in any case, now with this new executive director, they're hoping to continue to move forward. They seem to have a lot of momentum behind them, and they're hoping to really have things starting to work on, I believe, by spring. They'd be starting to do construction. They already own the property, and they really want to get this going as fast as possible.
A special town meeting this week in Bourne. Voters approved spending for a wastewater plant. We talked about this story a little bit and what the plant could mean for Bourne a couple of weeks ago. Update us on what's happening.
Well, again, they approved this $6.5 million appropriation for this wastewater treatment plant. And as I think we talked about previously and have been talking about for a long time, Buzzards Bay is an area in Bourne where they've been looking at trying to revitalize it, to bring in more business, to get more activity there. And one of the things that's been holding them back is their ability to say to businesses, we have essentially space for your wastewater. They have a deal with Wareham where they send about 200,000 gallons of wastewater to that town's wastewater facility, but they're really running close up to that limit, and they've basically had to or had businesses or developments kind of on hold or waiting for more access to get rid of wastewater, which obviously is a limiting factor when it comes to development. So that new treatment facility is going to be partially offset by this $1.5 million grant. It would treat about 100,000 gallons of wastewater a day, and officials see it as a real boost to kind of the development of that area, the potential development of that area. It's going to be on the same site as a new police station. And they say it's not expected to raise taxpayer bills and could be open by, I think, spring of 2019 if there are no delays. So, again, for them there in Buzzards Bay, certainly it seemed like it was a big deal, and the voters apparently decided, few voters, as it turns out, they were just above a quorum for this town meeting, I think two above to start the town meeting. So it was tight as to whether or not they were going to even be able to vote on it, but they did get it done.
A new shelter for victims of domestic violence opened this week on the Cape. I thought this is an interesting story.
Yeah, and this comes on the heels of a shelter that was in Falmouth, or with a Falmouth-based group, and that shelter ran into some problems earlier this year, where the Department of Public Health, that essentially regulates these types of facilities, said that there was concerns there about safety and security and other issues with staffing and things of that nature. So that four-bedroom facility, or contract for that four-bedroom facility, basically was taken away on June 30th. And Independence House, which has provided many services for victims of and survivors of sexual and domestic assault, kind of stepped in, had put in their application. I think both groups had put in an application for this contract with the state, and Independence House was chosen. And Independence House, which is based in Hyannis, will now operate this shelter. The location of the shelter itself is kept private for what should be obvious reasons. These are people who are, again, survivors of sexual and physical assaults, and they are worried about their safety and worried about the perpetrators of these assaults. And so they're going to open this 10-bedroom or 7-bedroom shelter. That's going to add to an inventory across the state of 177 rooms for survivors of sexual and domestic assault. And essentially it acts as also not only good for folks here on the Cape who are looking for this service, but also for people in other areas. And the idea is they kind of move people around sometimes, maybe to get them further away from where the assault took place and where the person who assaulted them lives, and also kind of just boosts the overall state accessibility to these sorts of services.
I want to jump now to a story Doug Fraser did that's in today's paper. It's about the resurgence, possibly, of a fish species, halibut, and it's a bit of a complicated tale.
Yeah, it is, and it has to do with basically the U.S.-Canadian border as much as anything. Halibut here in the United States are listed as a species of concern by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and essentially aren't fished for. I think fishermen can keep one halibut a day under current regulations. Meanwhile, across the border in Canada and Canadian waters, which once you get out there, there's a hard way to distinguish that, but it's the Hague Line, which travels out to the 200-mile barrier for all kind of international waters. Across the border, it's $100 to $200 million basically business for fishermen in Canada. So Cape fishermen in particular and other fishermen have said, well, do we really know how many halibut are out there in U.S. waters and what they're doing and whether there's a population there that's sustainable? In Canada, it's considered kind of a model of sustainable fisheries. Here, again, listed as a species of concern, and there's a limit on how many halibut each fisherman can take. So in any case, there's this grant that has been made available. I think the Nature Conservancy is kind of leading the charge with folks who are from all sorts of organizations, including the Cape Cod Fishermen's Alliance and other groups. And they're looking at basically tracking halibut and seeing how many are out there, whether these are Canadian halibut who are coming here, whether the population in the U.S. waters is sufficient for additional fishing. And one thing they found, there are a lot of open questions, but one thing they found is the habitat does exist in U.S. waters for these halibut. And they're also wondering whether or not it's just the way they're surveying the population that really matters. Do they have the right survey methods in place to try and figure out how many are out there? Fishermen are saying they're catching more and more halibut, multiple halibut a day, and they see it as a potential boon because they say one fish they can pay for their gas because they are really marketable, and when you go to a restaurant, it's one of the fish that people really do like to order and really appreciate being on their plate.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCod.com. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you, Steve.
And thanks to our other contributors. We heard from Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We spoke to Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, and we heard from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.